Okay, so today is September 29th. Really? Where did the summer go?
Shortest human life.
Just like about 2 weeks ago, it was the July 4th weekend, and now it's almost October. Wow. Okay, we start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa. Good morning and happy springtime to everybody. I'm sorry, springtime, I meant to say. Happy autumn to everybody. Okay, so today we continue with a tour through the chapter of the Majjhima Nikaya called the Chapter on Kings. And this time we come to sutta number 86, which is the Angulimala Sutta. This is the source of one of the sort of great stories of Buddhism, which is known throughout the Buddhist world. And children are taught this story from the time they're just little kids. And the story has been elaborated, amplified, expanded in various ways, dramatized, depicted in art. And as a result, there are numbers of variants on the story, various versions of it. So we have the version which has come down in the Pali canon, in the Majjhima Nikaya. But there are versions which have come down according to Venerable Analio. He found 5 parallels to the Angulimala Sutta in the texts of the other early Buddhist schools. Okay, the word Angulimala is the name of, we call the protagonist or the hero of the story. And the word Angulimala itself is a nickname or a sobriquet which is applied to a particular person. And the word Angulimala is a combination of the word Angula, which means finger, and Mala. Mala is a garland. So Angulimala means a garland of fingers. And the person who wears the garland of fingers is also called Angulimala. So one who wears a garland of fingers. And so if you see some of the pictures of Angulimala, a famous set of pictures, I think it was at the newly developed Jetavana monastery in India, where the Buddha had lived during many of the rains retreats. There's a series of murals, or I don't remember whether they were murals or paintings on canvas, but there's one of Angulimala chasing the Buddha with, you see, this big garland of fingers, finger bones around his neck. And he has a terrible expression on his face, long flowing mane of hair like a lion. Okay, so now we're coming into the actual story of Angulimala. the story behind that picture. Okay, so we begin when the Buddha is living at Jetavana, and we learn that, please take any seat. There's one up here. Okay. So we learn that on that occasion, there was he's called a bandit. The word used in Pali is chora. I remember last time we had some trouble with this. Pali is always pronounced like ch. So the word chora has a very broad meaning. Sometimes it can mean a thief, a robber, but it can be extended to almost any kind of criminal. So it's the Angulimala is called a bandit here. His main activity was not robbing people the way a bandit does, but killing people. And so we have the description. There was a bandit in the realm of King Pasenadi of Kosala named Angulimala, and he is described as murderous, bloody-handed, given to blows and violence, merciless to living beings. Villages, towns, and districts were laid waste by him, destroyed, depopulated, and he was constantly murdering people, and he wore their fingers as a garland. So now the question comes up, who is this Angulimala, and why is he wearing these fingers as a garland? Okay, we don't get the information in the sutta itself, but the commentary to the sutta, as well as commentaries on other places where Angulimala is mentioned, give us a background story. And I think some parts of the story come to be incorporated in the actual suttas that have come down in some of the other Buddhist traditions. And again, with stories that we find in the commentaries, we never know 100% how much is actually preserving historical fact and how much is the product of a kind of oral tradition and how much has been elaborated by different generations who have received this tradition and how much is purely the creation of the authors of these commentaries. And so what comes in the Pali commentary we can just say is part of the Theravada tradition, but some of this, or actually a great deal of it, is shared by texts in other Buddhist traditions. Okay, so the Pali commentary tells us that Angulimala was the son of a Brahmin in the court of King Pasenadi. And so in Buddha's time, the kings would have an entourage of Brahmins who would perform the religious functions of the state, the sacrifices, the rituals, the blessings, and often they would serve as advisors to the kings. Okay, so this Brahmin and, well, his wife one day gave birth to a baby boy, and this is quite natural. They would check the boy's horoscope, and they found that they found that there were a number of the houses and signs in the horoscope indicated that the boy, his destiny was to become a criminal. I guess there's a criminal sign, criminal house, different conjunction of planets. And so they were worried about this, disturbed. And the same night that the boy was born, King Basenadi saw a sort of strange phenomena in his palace. All of the weapons in his room, the swords, the axes, the armor, all were sparkling in a strange way. And so the king thought that something was inauspicious was going on. And so the father came to King Basenadi and reported about the birth of his son and the inauspicious constellations that governed his birth. And so they discussed the idea, what do we do with this boy? Maybe we throw him in the river, let him drown, get rid of him, just abandon him in the forest. But King Basenadi said, you're a Brahmin, you should bring up this boy, teach him morality, give him a good education, train him properly, and perhaps he will overcome those dispositions that are indicated by the horoscope. And so the Brahmin followed King Basenadi's advice, and they named the boy, they gave him the proper name, Ahimsaka. Does anybody know the meaning of Ahimsaka? Speak up.
Harmless.
Harmless, right. You might have heard the word Ahimsa often used in Indian traditions. It means non-harming. So Ahimsaka is one who doesn't harm others. So the boy's father probably thought if we give him a name that suggests the quality of harmlessness, that he will live up to that name and he will become a harmless person. And so the boy grew up, he seemed to be very mild, quiet, reserved, diligent. And then the commentary says when he reached, you know, maturity or like becoming the age of 20 or so, they sent him off to a university which existed at that time in a place called Takshila. The remains of it still exist now in Pakistan. Again here, I find this a little problematic because when we think of a university, we think of a place where there's a big library with a lot of textbooks that students will study. But in India during the Buddha's time, so far as the evidence indicates, that writing was either not yet used at all, or it might have been used just in the palace by the kings to keep records. Even the first edicts that we have records of, the stone edicts, are those of King Ashoka, who ruled about 100, 150 years after the time of the Buddha. We don't have in the suttas and the Vinaya, we don't find any references to monks taking notes as the Buddha spoke, or monks passing on their notes about the Buddha's discourses to other generations, but everything was learned and preserved through oral tradition. So it's still possible that in Takshila there was a place where learned men gathered in order to teach orally people who would gather around them to learn some of the, could be the arts of like medicine, astronomy and astrology, grammar, logic. In the Brahmin tradition, of course, the Vedas. Okay, so as the story goes on, it's said that Angulimala became, after arriving at Takshila, he enrolled himself to study with one very highly reputed teacher. In the India of the Buddha's time, a student would submit himself to the guidance of a personal teacher who becomes like his guru. It's not like in a modern university where you have Professor so-and-so for sociology, Professor so-and-so for English, Professor so-and-so for mathematics, another professor for physics, whatever. And so when Angulimala became the disciple of this teacher, he was very diligent, very earnest in his studies and also in attending upon the teacher in the teacher's personal life. And so all of the other students were thinking, since Angulimala has come here, the teacher doesn't pay much attention to us. He's so fond of Angulimala, and Angulimala is... Excuse me, when I went to high school, we had an expression. I don't know whether it's still used today. Brown nose? And when there was a student who was, you know, playing the teacher's favorite, he would always go like this. And then that student would feel embarrassed and have to show that he's can be rebellious and troublesome also, not always playing nice to the teacher. Okay, so the students were discussing amongst themselves, what are we going to do? And so as time went on, they were constantly being, you know, frustrated, feeling unhappy, jealous, envious of Angulimala. And so they decided, they launched a plot to separate Angulimala from his teacher. And what they did, not all together, not all the whole group at once, but at different times, you know, 2-3 students would come up to the teacher and say, you know, Angulimala is getting a bit friendly with your wife. And a little bit later, another group of students would come up to the teacher and say, you know, in the hallway we saw, or maybe behind the lecture hall, we saw Angulimala holding hands with your wife. And a little bit later, some other students would come and say, you know, we came into this deserted room, this empty room, where usually nobody goes, and who do we see there? But Angulimala and your wife. So as the teacher is getting these reports from different students, he's becoming more and more suspicious. And then, you know, when somebody becomes envious and suspicious, then everything that he sees will confirm the suspicion. So when the Angulimala would come to study with the teacher for a lesson, maybe the teacher would serve, I'm sorry, the wife would serve first the teacher a drink, refreshing drink, then bring a cup to Angulimala. And as the teacher, he's looking at them, he sees, didn't she smile at him in a peculiar way? Didn't he smile back at her? What's going on? So more and more his perceptions were confirming this utter fabrication to which there was no truth. And so he became convinced that the students were reporting the truth to me. So he wondered, what can I do to get my revenge at Angulimala? And this is where it gets a little weird, because I could think of 100 easier ways to get rid of Angulimala or to break up this apparently unwholesome relationship. But what the teacher did was to tell Angulimala, okay, now you finish your coursework, but you can't graduate yet, you can't get your degree. If you want to get your degree to show that you've graduated, you have to perform a special task for me. And what is the task? You have to bring to me 1,000 little fingers of people that you kill. So you have to kill 1,000 people and bring to me their little fingers. And then I'll confirm that you've completed your course of studies. I mean, why a teacher should give a command like that? Okay, according to I don't remember now whether this is the commentary or what I read in the modern interpreter trying to make sense of this. But I think the teacher's idea was that if Angulimala becomes assigned the role of a murderer, eventually the government will catch him and kill him. Then they'll get rid of him. And then, having been killed, as the karmic result of all of this killing, Angulimala will be reborn in hell and suffer terrible consequences. So that is said to be the teacher's motivation. If I wanted to get rid of Angulimala, what would we do? First I would just come out with the accusations. It's like a principle with, even when the Buddha hears a report about the misbehavior of some monk, he doesn't start assigning any kind of penalty to that monk at once, but he'll tell the other monks, go and call the Venerable so-and-so and bring him to my presence. Say the Venerable Arita, you could say in Sutta number 22, or the monk named Sati in Sutta 38, bring him to my presence. And then the Buddha will, surrounded by a few other monks, he'll say to that monk, is it true, as these monks are reporting, that you have been doing so and so? And then, of course, in the presence of the Buddha, if it's true, the monk will always admit to his transgression. And this becomes an embedded principle within the Buddhist system of discipline. If somebody is accused of a transgression and one doesn't immediately assign that transgression to him, but one has to call him into the presence and ask him to admit to it. But here, the teacher, without even questioning Angulimala, assigns this penalty to him. In a way that, to me, that doesn't make such good sense. And even if, say, Angulimala, if I had strong suspicion, I would just banish him from the school, or bring him before, perhaps the school has a disciplinary council, and discuss the accusation with them. But to immediately accept the accusation and then assign such a strange punishment like that, that sounds a little bit far-fetched. And then what makes things a bit stranger, well, two things. First, Angulimala accepts the decree from the teacher. You know, if I was going to back in graduate school and my teacher said, okay, we've read your dissertation is all right, but we can't give you a degree yet. You have to go out and rob a bank, even not killing a person. You know, down on 3rd Street, there's the Bank of America. Rob it. Oh, there. Or go down to the shopping mall and kill a few customers coming out of the shopping mall. You know, I'd say, what kind of guy is this? This is a madman, not a respectable professor. But Angulimala accepts the teacher's request, and so he goes off, he goes back to his home state, the state of Savatthi. Well, Savatthi is the city, the state of Kosala, and he sets up an abode at the top of what is called in the Jalani forest. There was a steep hill in that forest. In Angulimala, he might have been living in a cave on that hill. And he would look down, just below there was a road where travelers would go back and forth through the forest. And so Angulimala would look down there, and whenever he saw travelers moving along that road, he would come running down, kill them, and cut off their fingers. And in order to preserve the fingers so that he could eventually bring them back to his teacher, What he would do is first probably dry them out in the sun, then scrape away the remains of the... Sorry to be a little bit so coarse. Scrape away the remains of the flesh, and then thread the fingers onto a string so that they would form a garland around his neck. Again, this... assume that everything else makes sense, the question would come up. Now, if Angulimala was really a bright, clever guy, you know, in India, they would take the robbers who had been killed, and the paupers, they don't give them a proper funeral, or cremation, or burial, but they just throw the body in the charnel ground. So why not go to the charnel ground, cut off the fingers, and bring them home, or bring them to his cave, rather than killing people? The teacher won't know. So he could outdo the teacher. But Angulimala probably takes the decree of the teacher very literally, and so he starts cutting off the fingers, killing people, cutting them off. And according to tradition, this is in the commentary of the Pali tradition, and it comes actually in the sutta of some of the other versions of the story. In the other traditions, Angulimala was assigned the task of collecting 1,000 fingers. And then, again, this is the way the commentary is elaborating, Angulimala had collected 999 fingers. So he must have been sitting out of his cave and taking, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, putting them here, 10, 900, let's see, 875, I have to be exact now, whoops, I have to go back to the beginning, 5, 10, 15, 20, okay, so eventually he gets 999 fingers. And now, meanwhile, the report about this terrible killer, the serial murderer, has naturally spread to the city of Savatthi, and Angulimala's parents hear the story. And somehow, from the description, those who have seen an escape from the murderer, they've described him, what he looks like, they get the idea, this is our son. This is the fulfillment of that prophecy based on his horoscope. He's become the murderer, the terrible murderer in the Jalani forest. Then his mother gets the idea, strangely, that I have to go convince him to come back, to give up this murderous way, and I'll bring him some good food. Like a good, I guess the Indian mother is like a good Jewish mother, so she thinks, what will make my child happy? A good meal, the kind of food that he used to like. And so she makes some food, she comes into the forest, and she's walking down the road below where there's a footpath that goes up, turns off and goes up the hill. Angulimala looks down, sees her. First he sees, that's my mother coming. And then he thinks, wow, I can fulfill the command of my guru. That's my 1,000th finger coming up the hill. And so Angulimala is on the point, he's planning to kill his own mother. And what would be the consequence if Angulimala were to kill his own mother, according to formal Buddhist doctrine? Anybody? Speak. Do we have that? The microphone?
Thank you.
That's right. Yeah, that's good. There are five deeds, which are called the five terrible deeds, or the five types of extremely heavy karma. And if one commits any of these, then one cannot achieve any of the stages of enlightenment within this life itself. And then, as a result of committing these, one is destined for a lower rebirth, a rebirth in one of the hell realms. The five terrible deeds are killing one's mother, killing one's father, killing an arahant, of course intentionally killing them, deliberately and maliciously causing, shedding the blood of the Buddha. If it's not malicious, then it's of course not unwholesome karma, because some record comes in the Vinaya that the Buddha had some illness, and his doctor, who was named Jivaka, saw that the way to cure the Buddha of this illness was to bleed him, you know, to cut open a certain part, maybe of the leg or the arm, and get that bad blood out. So that's not in any way an offense. In fact, it's very wholesome because it's helping the Buddha regain his health. But maliciously shedding the Buddha's blood, that is actually committed. I think the only person who did that was Devadatta, the Buddha's evil-minded cousin. And then the fifth terrible deed is when the Sangha is in harmony, maliciously creating a schism. So to divide the Sangha so that they fight with one another. Okay, so if Angulimala were to kill his mom to get her finger, he's like shutting the door to any kind of attainment of enlightenment, any kind of higher realization, even closing the door to the possibility of a heavenly or human rebirth, and opening the door to a certain rebirth in hell. So apparently while this is going on, or maybe even before, when the mother was making her way through the forest, the Buddha sort of is in the deep meditative state, and he comes out and surveys the world with what is called the mind of great compassion, and he sees that Angulimala is there with the potential for enlightenment, for becoming an arhat. But he also sees that Angulimala is on the verge of committing one of the five terrible deeds. And so the Buddha wants to, in a sense, not to kill two birds with one stone, but to save two birds with one, say, with one cage. To save two sick birds in one cage. So what he does is to prevent Angulimala from killing his mother, saving his mother's life, and also to prevent Angulimala from committing a terrible deed, and in fact to become a monk and to achieve arhatship, to enable him to do that. So the Buddha is approaching the forest for that purpose. That is what is happening according to the background story when the sutta opens. And again, I have to repeat what I said earlier. How much of the background story is really historical fact? How much is a kind of construction of the Buddhist tradition? That we don't know, but it really makes a great story, whether it's true or not. Okay, so let us now continue and see what's going to happen. Do we have any film producers in this room? Movie directors? I'll write the screenplay for a great story. Okay, so it's morning, the Buddha dresses, he goes for his arms round in Savatthi. Then when he finishes his meal, he sets his resting place in order. he doesn't want to let the other monks know, because he sees that this is a mission he has to accomplish himself. If Angulimala sees the Buddha approaching with a whole group of monks, Angulimala might run off someplace. So this is a job that the Buddha has to complete on his own, solitary. So he just takes his bowl and his extra robe, and he sets out on the road leading towards Angulimala. Okay, then. Cowherds, shepherds, plowmen, and travelers see the Buddha walking along the road, and then they say to him, they give him the warning, don't take this road. This road will lead to the hiding place of the murderer, Angulimala, whose murderer is bloody-handed, and so on. Then they go on to report that he's constantly murdering people, and he wears their fingers as a garland. Men have come along this road in groups of 10, 20, 30, even 40, but still they have fallen into Angulimala's hands. Okay, so they give him this warning. The Buddha continues in silence. Okay, so again and again, each time, as the Buddha is walking on, he meets different groups of people along the way. They all give him the same warning, but the Buddha knows his mission, he knows what he has to do, what he can do, and so he just continues walking on silently. Okay, now, Angulimala, he's probably up in his lookout place at the top of the hill, and he sees the Buddha coming through the forest. First he sees him in the distance, and then he thinks that, you know, even groups of people have come through this forest thinking that they will be safe in groups, and I've gotten my hands on them and killed them. But here comes this ascetic. He's alone, unaccompanied. So he's coming along as if he's, you know, daring me to kill him, we could say. And then he thinks, okay, let me take his life. I'll get another finger from him. And if it's really true that he had 999, then instead of getting his mother's finger, he's going to get the Buddha's finger to complete his 1,000 fingers. Okay, so he takes up his sword and shield, apparently he has all of these weapons, the bow and quiver, and he follows closely behind the Buddha. Okay, now the Buddha now uses his supernormal powers. I take this to be true, that the Buddha does have these powers. I don't think this is pure story. But the Buddha performs this called a feat of supernormal power, such that Angulimala is running as fast as he can to catch up with the Buddha. And the Buddha is just walking along calmly, slow, probably at a normal pace, mindfully, as though he's not paying attention to what's going on around him. But Angulimala, though he's running as fast as he can, and the Buddha is walking slowly, calmly, mindfully, Angulimala can't catch up to the Buddha. It's almost as though he's frozen in his place. And the Buddha is always keeping the same distance, always the same distance between Angulimala and the Buddha. So Angulimala now thinks to himself, this is, when the text uses wonderful and marvelous, actually the Pali words, acharya abhuta, don't mean like this is wonderful, like something great and magnificent, but rather it's more like this is strange, this is perplexing, this is unbelievable. He says, I used to be able to catch up to all of these fast-running animals and catch them. But now, here I am running at full speed ahead, and there's this monk ahead of me, just walking at a normal pace, but I can't catch up to him. So then suddenly he stops and he calls out to the Buddha. He says, stop, ascetic, stop, ascetic. Then the Buddha, probably he turns around and says to Angulimala, I've stopped, Angulimala, you stop too. Then Angulimala thinks, somehow he has the idea that this monk in front of him, he says, he's a son of the Sakyans. Probably he doesn't immediately recognize him as the Buddha himself, but he thinks that this monk must be one of the followers of the Buddha. And so he thinks these recluses, these sons of the Sakyans, speak truth, assert truth, but though this recluse is still walking, he says, I have stopped. And he says, Angulimala, you stop too, even though Angulimala has stopped running. So then Angulimala says, I'm going to question this recluse. And somehow, I don't know if I was in a situation like this, I don't know how I could think of verses so well, but maybe the original account of the story maybe had been preserved in verse form for easy memorization, and these parts have been retained in verse. So Angulimala addresses the Buddha and says, you are walking, recluse, but you say you have stopped. And now I've stopped, but you say I haven't stopped. What is the meaning of this? How is it that you have stopped, but I haven't stopped? Then the Buddha says, Angulimala, I have forever stopped. I abstain from violence towards living beings, but you have no restraint towards living beings. That's how I have stopped and you have not. Okay, when the Buddha said this, somehow, the text doesn't say this, but suddenly there must have come into Angulimala's mind the realization that this recluse in front of me is none other than the Buddha himself. Somehow he must have heard, you know, the reputation of the Buddha had spread all over. And he must have known that the Buddha had his main monastery in Savatthi, the capital of the state of Kosala. And somehow, maybe it was the special appearance of the Buddha, the kindness and gentleness of his voice, maybe the firmness of his voice. Something made Angulimala realize first that this is the Buddha himself, not just one of the Buddha's monks. And second, that the Buddha has come to this forest not just on a, you know, on a journey, you know, chance journey, but he's come here especially for me, especially out of compassion for me. And so somehow that teaching of the Buddha, the verse that the Buddha spoke, must have reverberated deep into Angulimala's mind and heart and just broke down all of this violence in his violence and mercilessness and cruelty in his temperament. So he now recites, he says, at long last, this recluse, the venerated sage, has come to this forest for my sake. So he knows that the Buddha has come for him. Having heard your stanza teaching me the Dhamma, I will indeed renounce evil forever. So that's Angulimala's response. And then the compilers of the text fill in the rest of what happened in verse. Okay, saying thus, the murderer took his sword and his weapons and he threw them down a chasm. Then Angulimala goes up to the Buddha and worships his feet. And not only that, but right on the spot, he asks to be admitted into the Sangha as a monk. Then the next verse says, the enlightened one, the sage of great compassion, the teacher of the world together with its devas or deities, addressed him with these words, "Come, bhikkhu, come, O monk," and that was how he came to be a bhikkhu. So the Buddha has the special prerogative as the founder of the Sangha. He doesn't have to arrange a formal monastic ordination with other monks present, but if the Buddha thinks somebody is right, conditions are right, he'll just address him and say, "Come, O monk, lead the spiritual life for the attainment of liberation," and then just with those words, the person becomes a monk. And according to the commentary, again, this is, stretches the imagination a little bit. Well, it doesn't stretch the imagination, it stretches our credulity a little bit. When the Buddha says, "Come, monk," to somebody, then if they have the long hair and the beard, suddenly the long hair disappears, the beard falls off. He might be wearing, in this case, leather deerskins and leather. All of that disappears, and he is replaced by ochre-colored robes. Okay, any thoughts about this story so far? Okay, Richard, do you want to take the microphone?
What strikes me most is, one, that it's possible apparently to kill 999 people and be on the verge of arahantship.
Yeah, I have to say that.
This strikes me as a certain amount of lack of interest in killing that seems to contradict the first vow that, you not only won't kill, but you won't allow others to kill, you won't cooperate with it, won't
matter. Yeah.
I'm wondering how these two things are reconciled. On the other hand, the five things that are serious enough offenses to get you into hell, to make you a hell creature, right? Or matricide, maliciously spilling the blood of the Buddha, and causing a split in the Sangha, maliciously. What's the fifth one?
The fifth one is when the Sangha is living in harmony with malicious intent to cause a schism in the Sangha.
Oh, but this one was counting as the fourth.
Killing an arhat. Okay.
Killing an arhat. Yeah. Okay, alright. Well, there's three of these that are about killing.
Yeah.
I suppose maliciously causing a split in the Sangha. Killing, that's the first vow.
Yeah.
The maliciously causing a split, that's got to go with bad speech, right, and lying, right?
Yeah, generally that would be,
And then the one about shedding the blood of the Buddha maliciously, your chance to do that disappears when the Buddha...
Yeah, that's true.
So what I'm wondering is, how come when there are three sorts of people that you can't kill... And all of those are offenses that take you straight to hell so that you can't be enlightened.
Yeah.
But killing other people doesn't seem to interfere in any way with your ability to become an arahant.
Did you want to say something in response to that? Okay, let Barbara answer. Okay, I have it.
Yes, I think the difference is that the things that prevent enlightenment are things in the past, whereas the vows that you take when you become a bhikkhu are for future. And then what this story has always had a lot of meaning to me because I do work in a prison, that this story means that the Buddha would accept anybody.
Yeah.
Just the degree of the acceptance.
Yeah. Let me just sort of handle this from a more technical angle. Okay, if one kills... Killing any living being, of course, is proscribed by the Buddhist precepts, especially, above all, killing a human being. And if one is a monk, an ordained monk, and one kills a human being, then one has to be expelled from the order. One can't continue as a monk. It causes an automatic, it's called an expulsion offense. Okay, I think what's intended here is that these three people have especially heavy, you call them moral weight. One's parents, because they are the ones who give one life and bring one up. And the arhat, because that's the person who's fully liberated, so fully purified. So the karma generated by killing those three people, or types of people, is so heavy that it prevents automatically, inevitably, irreversibly, the possibility of achieving enlightenment in that lifetime. Of course, it doesn't prevent it from the possibility for future lifetimes. If one kills another human being, of course that is going to create very heavy, unwholesome karma. But there's still the possibility that somebody can transform themselves so much that they can cultivate the path and achieve liberation, or at least even achieve the first stage of liberation, perhaps even achieve the final result. And maybe this is in the Buddha's time, you know, quite a number of those who became monks came from the community of the Kshatriyas. So they would have been, I would assume, some of them at least, involved in warfare where they had to kill others. And then, you know, after they reach a certain age, then they, or through the unfolding of their life conditions, they decide they want to become a monk and to strive for the goal. So if they've killed the enemy in warfare, they can still become a monk and still make the effort. And if they're really diligent and they have other merits and virtues that developed, they could gain different stages of enlightenment. So it's not that there's nothing, that killing other people is in any way innocuous and doesn't create unwholesome karma, it doesn't create an obstacle to one's progress, it does. It's just that in those, the three cases of the terrible deeds, the obstruction is so heavy that it blocks off, through the working of the law of karma, it blocks off the possibility of awakening in that lifetime. Okay, the rest of you.
I have two other questions. One is, if it doesn't, that is, if killing other people,
okay, I could hear Johnny.
Doesn't break off the ability to be enlightened, then what is the purpose of expelling a monk if you kill somebody? That is, when the monk is expelled for having killed someone, I assume this virtually never happens, but is the idea that then he becomes incapable of enlightenment? Is he cut off because all the other monks believe that he can't be enlightened?
No, I think it's just to my understanding, the reason is just to lay down a very severe punishment for taking the life of another human being.
All right, but that degree of severity then applies to the monks, which apply and not to people who are not monks or not yet monks, which applies an enormous amount of difference between the clergy and non-clergy.
Well, it does, in the sense that somebody who takes the vow of a Buddhist monk and takes the precepts is expected to uphold very strongly. Well, there are four transgressions which are considered or called expulsion offenses. And so if one commits any of these, then one has to be expelled from the order. So these deal with very fundamental principles of the monastic life. One of these is engaging in any kind of sexual intercourse, whether heterosexual, homosexual, not distinguished in that respect. The second is stealing an object of, it's specified in the Vinaya in terms of the Indian currency of that period, so it's a little uncertain how it applies today. I would say stealing an object of such value that one would be likely to go to get a certain kind of prison sentence for that act of robbery. The third is taking the life of another human being. And then the fourth might sound a little peculiar, but that is making claims to different types of... knowingly making false claims to different stages of realization to one who is not ordained as a monastic.
I have a final question.
Yeah, but the one question you raised before, which I thought was the interesting one, is how is it possible for somebody, even if we take 999 as a legendary figure, how is it possible for someone with the potential for arhatship to maliciously take the life of even just 20, 30, 40 people at a time? I don't know.
No.
Okay, your last...
You know, in Indian villages in the summertime, it's horrifically hot, and so everybody wants to sleep outside on charpoys. And there are loads of rumors around Indian villages that women who sleep out at, outside at night may have their fingers cut off to get their rings. There's supposed to be lots of bandits who wander around and cut off women's fingers and steal their rings. So what I'm wondering is, if this is a common belief, why wouldn't Anguli Mula just think, well, I'll cut these people's fingers off, or I just need one finger from each or something. Why do they think you need to kill them?
Yeah, that's also it's an interesting question that I can't answer. Just like, why didn't he go to the charnel ground and cut off the fingers of the corpses? I don't know.
Katya?
Okay, take the microphone. Yeah, that is so, yeah.
So that's the answer to Richard's question. He was instructed to kill and then to sever the fingers.
Yeah, but still the question would come up, you know, how is the teacher going to know whether he actually killed or not? If he just wanted to get the fingers, he could cut the finger off, supposedly the woman who's sleeping outside, take the finger and say to the teacher, these are the fingers of people I've killed. And so the poor people who had their fingers cut off, they'll survive. They could go about their day-to-day tasks. They just have to do it with a missing finger.
Well, there's another question with that, and that is that why would the teacher think that Anguli Mula would take him seriously if he requires him to kill people? And it's like, the teacher could demand the figures without the killing. First, why would the teacher demand the killing for himself?
Yeah.
And two, why would he think that Anguli Mula would take him seriously?
I mean, that was the point that I brought up. I think when I was giving an account of the story, I took it from the other point of view, from Anguli Mala's point of view, why should he have any kind of respect or reverence for this teacher and think the teacher's word should be heeded in that case? I mean, even if I were, say, a university student in America, maybe I have a promise of a great job with some corporation, they say all you have to do is complete your degree at Yale or Harvard, and once you get that degree, we'll give you a job with, you know, $500,000 a year. And then my professor says, okay, you know, you've passed your qualifying exams, you've passed your oral defense of your position, your dissertation is passed, but you're not finished yet. You have to get the fingers of, let's say, 100 people. I'm going to think, what is this guy, a madman or something? I go to the police and report him to the police.
The whole thing, there's so many things like this whole story that it strikes me as an extraordinarily implausible story. And I have to think that the reason for the story is in order to counter what must have been, you know, common questions and beliefs, like people must have felt, well, the Buddha is so pure, he's so ethical, he's so good, he's so enlightened.
Yeah.
What is the point of my trying to become a Buddhist when, you know, when there's no way I can reach that kind of infinite goodness and enlightenment? And so Angulimala then is trotted out as the perfect example. Say, well, here's this guy. He can become enlightened. So don't tell me you're worse than Angulimala.
That's really excellent point. It's sort of like taking, I think, 2 points are coming through the story. One point is what you brought up is, you know, one can't conceive of doing almost anything worse than killing a lot of people. If somebody kills a lot of people, you think, you know, he's like the reckless, in Christian terms, we say the sinner who's bound for damnation. And so if he can be sort of transformed, converted, redeemed, and even brought on the path to arhatship, for me, because I spend a lot of hours on the internet and I'm lazy and wandering mind and occasionally craving and I get angry easily. I'm sometimes a little bit nasty to my friends. You can't tell me that I can't do it. Look, man, Angulimala did it. You guys do it too. So that's, I think, one of the sort of underlying motives behind the story. The other is, of course, a way of exalting the Buddha. You know, if, you know, Buddha can teach and transform people like Sariputta, Moggallana, Mahakasapa, or who are already truth seekers, you know, already inclined to the life of renunciation. They were already ascetics, wandering ascetics before they met the Buddha. Buddha transformed them, got them on the way to the realization of enlightenment. He could transform, you know, the decent, respectable young men and women of the towns. Okay, that's understandable, but you have to show that he can transform even the most degraded type of person. I haven't refreshed my knowledge of the Gospels recently, but aren't there comparable stories in the Bible about Jesus, the ministry of Jesus?
I think as extreme as this.
Yeah.
I mean, they're like, you know, when Jesus is on the cross, right, there's the thief and the murderer next to him, and he tells them he's going to be in paradise
and be saved.
Things like that. So certainly doing something that entitles you to be crucified under Roman law is not something that's going to prevent you from going to heaven and such, but there's nothing like Angulimala.
Yeah. Judy, was that your name?
Claudia.
Excuse me?
Claudia.
Claudia, that's right, Claudia, sorry.
I'm wondering if there is a side message here of the dangers of blindly following one's superiors and instead of one's direct experience, and that the example being so ludicrous makes it clear that, you know, even in a ludicrous, if somebody is inclined to not follow their own direct experience, how dangerous that can be, even when it would seem so irrational to do it. Do any of the texts talk about that as kind of a side message?
Yeah, that is a good point in relation to the way the commentarial version of the story has come down. Because it's in the commentary that we get, well, you know, we were actually discussing that story, but it's in the commentary that we get the version where it's the Angulimala's guru who gives him that command, and so he feels obliged to fulfill it because it's the command of his teacher. I haven't seen that discussed in the commentary, it's in the Pali commentary itself, but in a modern account of the Angulimala story, which is in a book that I actually put together. It's called Great Disciples of the Buddha, but it's, this version was written by a German scholar named Helmut Hecker. He wrote the Angulimala account. He develops this point that it shows how in India in the Buddha's time, people would blindly follow the decree of their guru, no matter what the guru said. And of course this goes against the Buddha's advice in the Kalama Sutta. You know, do not follow the instructions of a guru thinking that he is respected by us. But, you know, use your own moral reflection, what is wholesome, what is unwholesome, and reject the unwholesome, do what is wholesome. Yeah, so this applies to the way the story has come down in the commentary. In the sutta itself, we don't find that part of the story where it's the instructions of the teacher that leads Angulimala to this murderous career. Did you have another, Barbara?
We know, I think, that much of the Pali Canon we can thank Ananda for, that their reports.
Yeah.
Is that true of the stories also? What do we know about the real origin of the story, if anything?
Yeah. I mean, this brings up another point, which I think is partly legend, which is the story that everything in the sutta comes down through what Ananda had heard, and then what he reported, and so the scriptures have been preserved exactly as Ananda had remembered them. If that were the truth, then every one of the early Buddhist schools would have preserved the suttas in exactly the same form. There would have been no differences between them. But from the fact that there are differences in the different versions, though the teachings are basically the same, but the way some sections get developed differently in one transmission and in another transmission, sometimes a portion which in one tradition is in this sutta turns up in another tradition, in another sutta. We know that quite a bit has been added, transposed, developed, elaborated, compressed. Yeah, so I mean, this regarding the methodology, probably the most reliable methodology is to compare the different versions of a sutta that we have. If that one has to know, say, Pali, Buddhist Sanskrit, to the extent that there are some Sanskrit fragments of suttas that are left, Chinese, because many of the collections were transmitted into Chinese, some translated into Tibetan language, then there's a language which was used in the northwest of India. They call it Gandhari, and some versions of some texts have come down in that language. So what one does is to take the different versions, compare them to the extent that one can find a common core that we could say, we still can't say that this definitely comes from Ananda, but we could say that this is probably the oldest core of the story, or the oldest nucleus of a sutta. Then what comes later, we have to negotiate between them, see what seems most logical, most probable. It's a pretty complex task.
So what do we know anything about the likely origins of this particular story from that process?
I would say no.
Okay.
I think it's quite possible that there was an original story about a murderer who was taught and transformed by the Buddha and then admitted as a monk and achieved arhatship. Because a version of this, or at least an allusion to it, does come down in the Vinaya Pitaka, the Book of Discipline, when when the Buddha was established the monastic order and then he was giving, or he allowed the monks to give the ordination to others, and he himself was giving ordination to others. Angulimala was ordained, of course, by the Buddha, as reported here, but this is also reported in the Vinaya. And then it's said that Angulimala at the time had been, today his poster would have been put up in the post office or the police office, wanted dead or alive. You know, a decree had gone out, if anybody captures Angulimala and brings him to the court of Savati, he gets a great reward. But here the Buddha ordained Angulimala, rendering him invulnerable to capture and to a criminal trial. So then this complaint came to the Buddha from the king. And so the Buddha laid down a decree that from now on, any criminal who is wanted by the king, we would say, or wanted by the state, cannot be given the ordination. We would say a felon, a wanted felon, cannot be ordained. He should be, it's part of the questions that are asked of a candidate for ordination. Are you wanted for a crime, in effect? Similarly, a criminal who's escaped from prison and then seeks ordination cannot be given the order, cannot be ordained. Because if the Buddha went on allowing criminals wanted by the state to take ordination, then the Sangha is going to fill up pretty quickly with a rather undesirable. You know, the kid says to his mom, "Mom, I'm going to the monastery to see the monks." The mother would say, "Oh, my child, he's such a good boy. He goes to the monastery to listen to the monks." No, the mother's going to say, "Don't go there. It's a dangerous place. You'll get yourself killed." You know, it's like in my days when we were growing up, I would say, "Mom, I want to go to the candy store to buy some candy." "No, don't go there. That's where all, you know, during the day, the afternoon, the tough guys used to hang out." And when they see the studious little little boy passing by, you know, get "Hey, idiot, what are you doing? Read the books. Come here, idiot." Any further comments? Okay, I think we'll stop here, and then next week we'll have, this will be the concluding class on the Angulimala Sutta. I actually thought that I could get it all in today, but I thought the issues brought up by the background story are quite interesting to discuss. And next week I think we have to have the class here again, because there is there is a program going on next week which you might also want to enroll for. Is Kaidi here right now? Yeah, there's a program, it's called Spiritual Retreat at the Monastery, a sort of introduction to the life in the monastery. The Spiritual Retreat, it starts on Friday. Evening is registration, 5 o'clock registration. Then you spend Friday evening, Saturday all day, and Sunday up through lunchtime in the monastery, living like a monastic style life. And there'll be, it's not just a meditation retreat, but you have Dharma talks, introduction to different rituals in the monastery, the daily routine in the monastery. So if you want to enroll for that, you could still, they do it through the internet, through the Baos website. You can, there's online registration, so you can do that. And I'll give talks, I think on Saturday afternoon I give a talk, on Sunday morning. But we could have the class next week, we could have it here, Saturday morning. Yeah, I will do that, because after that, October 13th, we have our Buddhist Global Relief Walk to Feed the Hungry, and I want to encourage everybody who's here to come for that, if you're able to. It will be in New York. Let me just take a little sip. I have a bug in my throat. Yeah, this is a nice drink, by the way. You prepared it for me? Last week. You had prepared it last week, too? Okay, October 13th. This is the Walk to Feed the Hungry. It will be on Riverside Park in New York City. The registration starts actually 9:15, but even if you get there 9:30, there's still plenty of time to register. Then we walk from 10 to 11. It's about an hour walk. Then we have a picnic lunch and a little closing, some Dhamma talks to close the event. So please do come. And to find more details about it, you can go to the website of our organization, Buddhist Global Relief. It's the URL is www.buddhistglobalrelief, all is one word, .org. Then the following week I have to go to California. I'm going to California for 3 weeks. So the next class after next week will be, I come back November 9th, November 10th we'll have a class. And I'll make up the schedule after that. And then during the winter we don't have classes, I understand. From January on for 3 months. Okay, so let us share the merits, then we can go up and have lunch, and then we'll have the further discussion. I guess in Kuan Yin Hall you're doing part of the ceremony there. But all the things have been moved over, the tables and chairs. We can come back here for the discussion. Okay, so let's share the merits. Akasata Chibumata Deva Nagamhika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Sasanam Akasata Chibumata Deva Nagamhika Punyantang Anumodipa Chirang Rakantu Desanam Akasata Chibumata Deva Naga Mahedika Punyantam Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Mankaram Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Etavata Cham Hehi Sampadam Punya Sampadam Sabe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya etavata cham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya bhavagupadaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha Asanya sanino dukkha pamucchantu pusantu nibbutin. Okay, then we end with three bows to Buddha. Oh, this is. there is the chime. Now we see the chime. It's behind the Buddha statue. We just do have three half bells because it's. Actually, we always do three half bells. So.
Okay.